You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Jim Goldston with the Open Society Justice Initiative, and we're very pleased to welcome you to this evening's discussion on the collapse of Cambodian democracy and the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. We have with us three great panelists who are going to be looking at what has been happening in Cambodia and what has been the impact of the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia in operation now for a decade. To my immediate right is David Tolbert, the president of the International Center for Transitional Justice, the former special expert to the UN Secretary General on the ECCC, if I can call the extraordinary chambers that. And David brings, of course, a diverse range of experiences dealing with mass crimes in lots of places around the world. To his right is Phutsata Rieng, who is an author and journalist who's followed closely the work of the ECCC and also broader developments in Cambodia. And to Phutsata's right is Heather Ryan, a consultant with the Open Society Justice Initiative, who has was based in Phnom Penh for quite some time and has also monitored the court very, very closely. So we really have people who know what they're talking about, which is a good start for a great panel. Now, 20 years ago, when the discussion was happening about, gee, this horrific set of crimes had happened in Cambodia, and there had been not a shred of accountability for those crimes. It was a very different time in the world, and perhaps in Cambodia as well. The international justice movement was on an upswing. There was momentum, which in 1998 would result in the adoption of the Rome Statute, and a few years later, the creation of a permanent international criminal court. There were new courts, it seemed, being created to deal with the crimes in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda and in other places. Human rights was not a bad phrase, a bad term. And there was hope among some that democracy would flower in places like Cambodia, and that that country would be able to recover from the horrific violence which it endured for so many years. We're now 10 years into the functioning of the Extraordinary Chambers, the court that was ultimately created, and we'll be looking at the performance of that tribunal, but we'll also be noting that just in recent months, the situation in Cambodia in general has really deteriorated significantly. Just yesterday, several dozen organizations, civil society organizations, both based in Cambodia and internationally, sent a public letter to the conveners of the 1991 Paris Peace Conference on Cambodia, asking that the Paris conference be reconvened in light of the extraordinary deterioration in political conditions in Cambodia, and just noting that the letter said that since July of this year, the royal government of Cambodia has embarked upon a severe crackdown against the political opposition, against civil society organizations and independent and critical media, as well as individuals exercising their fundamental freedoms. The severity of this crackdown is unprecedented in the post-1991 era and poses an existential threat to Cambodian democracy, the letter says. So one of the things I'd like to explore is what's the relationship between the deterioration of democracy and human rights in a country and whatever we can say about the performance of this extraordinary chambers and the search for accountability for these horrific crimes by the Khmer Rouge. So maybe Phutsata, if I can start with you to kind of set the stage a little bit, and maybe if you could remind us, some folks here I'm sure know very well the situation in Cambodia and about the court, and some may be less familiar. But maybe to put us all on the same page, just remind us why the court came into existence, what it was intended to do, who was it going to serve?
Did I get that? This court came into existence really to do something that had not happened in Cambodia before, which was, in fact, to administer justice. Just a bit of context here for those of you who are not as familiar with Cambodia. When the genocide occurred under the Khmer Rouge communist regime between 1975 and 1979, 2 million people died under the regime of starvation and torture. What that left was 7 million people who then had to live the last 40 years with the scars and with the memories of the hardships and the memories of burying their dead and the trauma of their experiences. There was no justice for them. And so this court was founded on the belief and the idea that justice needed to be served in the country. And also, just a little bit of context for Cambodia. Prior to the existence of the ECCC, there really was no sense of rule of law in the country. There's something that we in Cambodia came to know as the People's Court, which is to say that the judicial system in Cambodia was so broken, and the populace distrusted the system so much because it didn't work, it was corrupt, that people literally took matters of crime and punishment into their own hands. And there was this, what turned into an epidemic of mob rule in Cambodia, which was that any time a crime happened, usually petty crime, let's say somebody had stolen a chicken or a motorbike, if that thief was caught, villagers would surround this young man, usually it was a man, and literally beat the man to unconsciousness and sometimes to death. And so I think that the role of the ECCC coming into existence served to address, at least to bring some sort of minimal standards for what justice means in Cambodia and some process and protocol surrounding that. I know that just in recent years, I have not seen the same level of mob rule incidents as was happening in the late 1990s and early 2000s. I can't say that we should be crediting the ECCC for that, but I can say that this is part of the picture.
And Heather, maybe just turning to you briefly, some of the purposes of the ECCC, if I recall, were to provide a modicum of accountability for these horrific crimes, and to demonstrate what a functioning court that worked in accordance with basic fair trial standards would look like. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And that points up one of the sort of conundrums that the court has always faced. When the international community wanted to have a court in Cambodia and was interested in supporting Cambodia having a court, there was a feeling that the Cambodian justice system was so corrupt and so sort of didn't have the knowledge, the sophistication, the background to conduct trials of the kinds of crimes that were committed by the Khmer Rouge. The international community initially was supporting a international tribunal, like the one for the former Yugoslavia. But the Cambodian government was adamant, Hun Sen, who's currently the president at the time, and his government was adamant that this be a domestic court. So it was this conundrum where we want to help build the Cambodian domestic judicial system and do that by supporting it with its efforts to try these horrendous crimes. But on the other hand, if the United Nations and other countries are going to participate in this endeavor, it's essential to them and to all of us who support international justice that the that the tribunal operate consistent with international standards of fairness and impartiality, respect for the rights of defendants, transparency, and lack of corruption. So there has always been this tension between the domestic part of the court, which is infected with political interference and corruption and things like that, and these attempts then to bring it up to international standards. And so the court's been challenged in that regard, and in some ways it's succeeded, and in other ways it hasn't. But it has managed to complete three trials of three accused, and done so in a manner, while not perfect, certainly I think in general can be regarded as meeting basic international standards, and in meeting standards that are by far much better than the standards in the average courts in Cambodia. So it does serve as an example of a different level of justice than Cambodians are used to seeing in the normal domestic courts.
Would you say then, Heather, that the court has achieved what it was meant to accomplish?
I think it has in some respects, and it has not in other respects. In terms of demonstrating a certain level of accountability for gross atrocities, it has achieved that standard. Three people have now been tried and convicted and are in prison, and there are still proceedings ongoing. And in addition to that, I think it's had a very important impact on Cambodians more generally and on civil society specifically in Cambodia. And Putsada can probably talk more about this, but there's been many developments in Cambodia over the last several years that have been very positive that I think are directly related to the presence of the court there, even though they're not particularly judicial related issues. That includes teaching about the Khmer Rouge history in grade school and high school. It includes a much more sophisticated understanding of mental health issues related to things like post-traumatic stress disorder. It includes just much more discussion within communities and families about what happened personally to people in Cambodia and what happened to their country. And hopefully, in terms of what's going on now, it raised a kind of understanding and expectation about impunity, that you can't get away with just anything. At some point, there are mechanisms to bring people to account. Now, it hasn't been as good as it could have been, and we could maybe talk about that a little bit later, some of the problems. We all wish it would have done more and done better, but I think it's definitely true that it has achieved some of its goals to a measure that's significant for the people of Cambodia.
Great. Putsata, I'm going to come back to you, but first I want to ask David to introduce another element to this story. This was a tribunal that was deeply important to Cambodia and Cambodians, but it was also important to the international community, right? And yet there was not a great deal of consensus around its creation. If I recall, the leading United Nations experts, bureaucrats, who were tasked to look into the possibility of accountability came back and recommended initially that the UN not go forward with the tribunal because they couldn't get the conditions from the Cambodian government they felt would be necessary to ensure independent and impartial justice. What happened, and have they been, how would you assess the UN's role in this process, given that it started with such difficulty there?
Yeah. Do you mind if I make, I want to just make a comment on what Heather said, and then go into your question, Jim, because I do think that if we look at the impact of the extraordinary chambers. One of the most important elements, I think, of any transitional justice mechanism, and I would broadly put the extraordinary chambers in that category, is how does it impact the society? And I think some of the examples that Heather has given And I saw this myself. First, I must make a little bit of disclaimer. I was the special expert a number of years ago when I had much darker hair, and I guess it was 2008, 2009. So I come from a slightly different point of view on this. But the impact of the tribunal, I don't think, should be measured simply in the number of cases tried. At the end of the day, we see changes in the textbooks, we see changes in the narrative, we see engagement by civil society. Now, a lot of that's probably at risk with the crackdown of the government. But these are really important achievements from a kind of transitional justice point of view. And I mean, I saw this myself, and I think Heather's reported on this. So I think that it's important to bear that in mind, because as a judicial mechanism, it is, you know, it's the work of drunken sailors. I mean, the hybrid court that was put together with the supermajority system was enormously difficult to manage. It has produced, it has ended up with extremely long trials and a lot of other difficulties. And part of that goes back to what you said in your question, Jim, and that is there was a lot of disagreement originally about how to address this, and there were not the circumstances, at least the experts did not think they were the circumstances for a national court. There were then political negotiations that led to a court that was a hybrid, but was composed of the supermajority component, essentially a political compromise to have some kind of form of justice. And the judicial difficulties and the difficulties that we see and the implementation of the extraordinary chambers are baked into the agreement and baked into this political compromise with a supermajority system and with the Cambodian side having control really exclusively of their side and the internationals having control over their side. This led to endless headaches regarding corruption, regarding management, and a whole array of other issues that I'm glad to dig into. You look like you want to ask me another question, though, so. No. Okay. So when I was the first special expert on this, we were dealing with a corruption crisis, a deep kickback crisis, a deep kickback situation on the national side. And frankly, on the international side, the UN had no power over the national side, and the reputation was being risked. I'll tell you over a couple of drinks how we were able to resolve that, but I had to go to the Deputy Prime Minister and have a long negotiation, and there was a kind of face-saving device. The person who was taking the kickbacks exited. I won't say that the situation was perfect after that, but it certainly helped. But even the very makeup of the court, you had the national sitting on one side of the building and the international sitting on the other side. It is exactly opposite of how a hybrid is supposed to work, because a hybrid is supposed to be teams working together and some capacity building and sharing of information and knowledge. So this was very much a political compromise. It would not have worked without enormous support from the UN and from a number of states that continued to support the court financially and to some extent politically. Obviously, I think we're reaching potentially a real crossroads with the changes in the political dynamics in the country, which are, like this country, not exactly in the same way, but going in the wrong direction. So I'm glad to go into all of that. But those are some of the issues that I would identify.
And just to clarify, when we say supermajority, if I understand it correctly, we're saying that precisely because the Cambodian government negotiated a majority of its judges on the court, in contrast to some other hybrid tribunals, the international community demanded and won an agreement that in order for most decisions to take effect, you would have to have not just a simple majority, but a supermajority, majority plus another judge to ensure that decisions would require not only the agreement of Cambodian judges, but at least one international judge. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially. The one international judge or one international prosecutor or one international investigating judge or magistrate could block, and this could only be overturned if you had an international join the national side. So it was an ultimate check to ensure that even though the majority was Cambodian, that the international side, you would have to at least convince one international judge to go along with a particular decision. And so a very messy compromise, but one that was essential for the functioning of the court.
Yeah. I remember when I was in Cambodia on a number of occasions hearing some folks who were very enthusiastic about the court, but others saying, you know, we have lots of problems in this country. And, you know, here come these international donors, and they're spending tens of millions of dollars supporting judges, prosecutors, trying one, two, three people. Yes, they did bad things, but is this really the priority for us? So I'm just wondering if you could just share to what extent was justice in this form a priority for Cambodian people? And to what's your sense of how people feel it's done so far and what it means to them now?
You might have been talking to my very relatives who have often talked to me about and expressed those very sentiments that by $300 million could sure build a lot of schools and a lot of hospitals for Cambodia's broken healthcare system and for an education system that continues to be lacking. But I think that, you know, it's important for us to put the court into some context here. And I think I can try to answer your question in a little bit of a roundabout way. I want to just to reemphasize something that Heather mentioned, which is that at the end of the day, at a very basic level, three indictments were made in this case. And what does that mean for Cambodia? Yeah, it was three to the tune of $100 million per indictment. But what does this ultimately mean for Cambodia? It means that there is justice in a country where there had not been. And there are international standards there. And I think that it's important to keep that in mind as we continue the discussions, because ultimately, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the courts and the judicial system did not work in Cambodia before the ECCC. The courts and the judicial system don't work today. But at least we can say three people have been indicted, three people have been held to account. What that means is that Cambodian people, like my relatives, they can have hope. They can see what's possible. And I think that when you see what's possible and when you see that justice is possible, that is where people can begin to have hope for the country. A little bit of context for the court itself that I think is really critical here is that 10 years ago, when the courts began to get established, Cambodia was facing a really unique moment in time with its young people. There were a lot of Cambodian youth who did not believe that the genocide happened. This is because the country was shrouded in complete silence about the Holocaust in Cambodia. And parents and grandparents were too traumatized to speak of the past. Plus, you have the Buddhist religion that basically says you don't look back, you keep moving forward. There's no point in pondering about the past and thinking about it. And so I think that the court came about at such a critical moment in Cambodia's history in the sense that for the first time, people were hearing in the news throughout the country of the court's existence. And it was sparking a level of discussion and dialogue and openness among a lot of Cambodians, including among my own relatives, to actually share what happened during the genocide. These were the first murmurings of what happened in the genocide that I had heard from my own family members. And I think that I can't underline just how significant that is for Cambodian people to finally have some sense of motivation or somebody asking them. And I can't help but think to one young woman in particular when the court, the very first day of the court happened, somebody who was in the audience. When I was working as a journalist in Cambodia, I lectured at the Royal University of Phnom Penh's Department of Media and Communications, and there was a young woman sitting in the front row who was very eager to hear what it was like to be a journalist in America and to hear the history of, you know, our free press in this country. And on the very first day of the opening day of the extraordinary chambers, I felt this tap on my shoulder. Well, it was this young woman, Kunila. It was the middle of the morning, so she was clearly skipping class, which I asked her about, but she was skipping class for a good reason. She said that she had heard about the tribunal happening through the news, in the news, and she had heard about this genocide, but she didn't really understand what the genocide was about. And so she went to court that day. She went other multiple days, and eventually she worked up to going home and asking her mother if her mother had experienced what her mother had experienced of the genocide. And for the very first time, her mother told her stories about surviving the Khmer Rouge and her struggle. And I think that these kinds of anecdotes, I think of Kunila, and I think of how many dozens and hundreds of people are like Kunila, whose families for the first time heard these stories. If we talk about history not repeating itself, well, we have to know our history in order to not repeat that history. And I think that the courts play that critical role.
Thank you very much, Putsata. David, did you want to come in on that?
No, we should just hire you for ICTJ, because that's exactly it's exactly what we think. And I think I'd just expand a little bit on that, because this idea of outreach or telling the story of what's happened in the courtroom, it began in the Yugoslavia tribunal, mostly under Gabriel McDonnell, who was the president. I worked on that extensively. But I think that it was done in a way that was extremely effective with the ECCC in Cambodia. The setting was very bad. They put the courtroom way outside of Phnom Penh. It was a long ride. But many, many school children went and watched the proceedings. There was a great deal of commitment by the prosecutors, by the judges, by other members of the court to go out to affected communities and talk about what the extraordinary chambers was doing. And it, I think, had an impact much greater than a lot of the other courts that I've worked with or seen in terms of in those affected communities and across the country. Despite the government's resistance to that, despite a lot of pushback, and I think it compares quite favorably to other tribunals' efforts to reach the public and to have outreach. And one of the things that concerns me about the whole outreach phenomena is that it tends to sort of become a kind of check-the-box approach, that, well, we need a bit of outreach, we've got a court or a truth commission or some kind of process. And what I think so important about what happened in Cambodia is that story then got into the textbooks. People like Yuk Chung and others ensured that the truth or the mass killings and the Khmer Rouge were in the textbooks. And this has an enormous impact for the future generations. And so this is one of the reasons I think, despite the bad design, despite all of the failures that occurred in the extraordinary chambers, and we can make a long critique of that, that there has been an impact in the society in a way that I've seen other tribunals not, for example, who I've worked at several tribunals that I've felt like have failed to make much of an impact in any community. And because of, I think, the commitment of the leadership to some extent, the commitment of your organization, OSJI, and others. That story has been able to get out well beyond the boundary, the premises of the court, into community, so that it actually makes a difference and makes never again more real to people, young people, and others. Something
really very heartening to hear. If I can play devil's advocate, however, and ask Heather to get a little into the weeds. I mean, you know, it looked at from one perspective, yes, three people have been convicted of very, very serious crimes. But they're all people whom Prime Minister Hun Sen said from the very beginning, yep, those are the people we want to be tried here. And essentially nobody else. And that's in fact the way it's worked out. The tribunal, at least viewed from one perspective, has simply served the interests of a government which is deeply partisan, and as we said at the beginning, and we'll talk about more, has been increasingly ruthless in not tolerating any independent voice or any opposition. Heather, maybe you can just talk a little bit about there are other cases, other investigations beyond the three that have been completed, which some folks believe would demonstrate, if they were to be completed, the capacity for truly independent justice, because the government has made clear it doesn't want those cases to go ahead. What's the prospect for that? Where does that stand?
Jim, you've identified the basic flaw in the operation of the court is this fundamental problem that it appears at this point, 10 years into the court, that we can say that the trials of the people that the government is willing to let be tried and tried to judgment have gone ahead with little interference by the government and essentially fair trials. But when we get to other cases where the government, for whatever reason, and we're not sure exactly why that is, cases that the government does not want to go forward, those cases have been stymied, and in significant ways. Now, as we talked about, there's three cases that have gone to judgment. One is on appeal now. Not on appeal. There's the trial court has finished a third case, and they're writing the judgment now. But three people have been tried and convicted and sentenced, and their appeals are finished, and they're spending the rest of their life in jail. There are four other people that are under investigation in two cases that we call the 003 and the 004 case. The investigating judges in one case have agreed to dismiss one of those people, a woman named Im Cham. So she has been dismissed. They said she's not senior enough for us to try in this tribunal. There's three remaining accused persons, and those cases, the investigation has been concluded, and we're waiting for the process to go forward, and the next step will be we will get either an indictment from the investigating judge or a dismissal of those cases. Now, as Jim said, there are two investigating judges, one Cambodian and one international, and the judges have not been cooperating in the investigation. The Cambodian judge, consistent with the statements of Hun Sen, refuses to investigate those cases. He says those cases should not go forward. So they're only being investigated by the international investigating judge. And it's likely that the process of appeals and the procedural process to get those cases to the trial chamber, even if there is an indictment issued, will at some point be stopped. For instance, I sort of fantasize, there's lots of scenarios about how this could happen, but if there's an indictment issued by the international investigating judge, then the case, after a few intermediate steps, goes to the trial chamber. And in the trial chamber, you have three Cambodian judges who say these should not proceed. There's no jurisdiction to proceed with these cases. And two international judges who say we want to proceed. You can't go any further. The cases would get dismissed at that point. And so I think because of the lockstep action of the Cambodian judges at the court with respect to these three cases, it's unlikely that ultimately they'll go to trial. But we hope they go through the process in a transparent way so that we can see what happens to them and that some of the investigation work that has been done may become public if there is an indictment issued, and that will generate some additional information. Now and this is very bad for the court to see, have a court where, you know, the government essentially can choose who gets indicted, and if they want to protect someone, they can. That's the essence of non-independent judiciary. I think the Cambodian people are very aware of exactly what's going on, you know, and nobody is being fooled by this. And so we don't have the Hun Sen government adopting the lessons we hoped it would about how a judiciary operates independently. And that perhaps is the biggest disappointment of this court and the biggest lost opportunity of this court.
So, Putsata, if Heather just said that one of the hopes is that however these cases end, it's done transparently and at least through the participation of people observing, civil society and others, there'll be fulsome discussion about what the judicial process has meant. But we're in a period of complete collapse of the possibility for democratic space for discussion, yes? So what's likely to transpire?
Absolutely, and you bring up such a critical point, Jim. We're in some very trying times in Cambodia right now. It's been really disheartening as a Cambodian American on this side and in kind of my safe bubble in Seattle to be watching what's going on back in the country where I was born. But at the moment, just to give a little bit of context for what is happening, there will be general elections in July of next year, in July 2018. And well in advance of those elections, the Prime Minister has taken an opportunity, as he is wont to do in advance of every general election prior to this upcoming one, to really ratchet the screws on dissent. And how that has played out in the country is that media has been targeted, international organizations have been targeted, and the opposition party itself is a prime target of the prime minister. And this is, as I mentioned, this is really a cycle of Hun Sen and part of his tactics that prior to any general election in the years intervening, he'll allow a certain measure of democratic space to exist. Journalists can enjoy writing about controversial topics, including illegal logging and land grabbing. But then just prior to a general election, that's when we really see the hammer come down, when the prime minister himself is feeling under threat. What's particular about this instance of a crackdown, and what's really disheartening is the severity of the crackdown. This is the first time that the prime minister has targeted international media, the Cambodia Daily, which has been considered really the most independent source of news in Cambodia for upwards of 24 years, was forced to close down under legal threat and under a sham accusation that it needed to pay $6.3 million in back taxes. National Democratic Institute, an international NGO, NDI, which has been serving in Cambodia, working in a political context, again, more than 20 years, NDI was kicked out, and then Kem Sokha, the president of the opposition party, the CNRP, Cambodia National Rescue Party, has been imprisoned, and so there's a real severity to what's going on, which I think speaks to the desperation and the panic and the anxiety of the prime minister that the voices of dissent and disillusionment and displeasure regarding his rule that that's growing and that he needs to do something to ensure that the opposition doesn't grow any further, as he saw back in the 2013 elections, where there were unprecedented protests in the streets. That was met with very bloody end. Several people were killed when those protests were violently suppressed. My biggest worry is that 2018 is either going to be a repeat of 2013 or possibly worse in that regard. And so I think that what this means, given the context of what's happening with the ECCC, I can't help but think of the incredible irony and complete dysfunction of Cambodian society at this moment, that on the one hand, we could have former Khmer Rouge leaders who are partly responsible for the deaths of 2 million Cambodians be brought to justice so that these basically men would not get away with murder, while at the same time we have a prime minister who literally is getting away with murder, whether literally or not, vis-a-vis extrajudicial killings that happened prior to elections, whether he's involved in them or whether his lack of investigating them, he's part and parcel to the problem. I mean, let's not forget that though this spate of recent activity within the past few months of this crackdown has happened, just a year ago, an opposition leader, Kem Lee, was gunned down while having coffee, and he was considered, a very hopeful figure for Cambodians who've been disillusioned by the current CPP, Cambodia People's Party, rule.
I do want to open this up to the colleagues in the audience for discussion. Before doing so, David, I just want to ask you, if I could, to reflect, given